copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Let me just first of all introduce the subject that we're going to be dealing with. Most of you will see the title of this session, which is Surviving, or How to Survive in Ministry, which is a title that makes certain assumptions about Christian ministry leadership and some of the particular challenges. Most of us will have perhaps seen situations where we've seen ministry leaders either struggling or falling with particular temptations. There are also often very great pressures on those in Christian ministry leadership. Anxiety, depression, burnout are not uncommon amongst those in pastoral or Christian ministry leadership. The question which the panel is going to be addressing then is, well, first of all, is this a particular problem in Christian ministry leadership? And if it is, well, what factors might be contributing to that? Is it something peculiar to the nature of Christian ministry and leadership of churches and Christian organizations? Or is it something perhaps peculiar to the personalities of people who end up doing those kinds of jobs and being involved in those kinds of roles? Those are the kind of questions we'll need to discuss and look at some of the factors that might contribute to these kinds of situations. The question really being addressed is issues surrounding this question of the flourishing and the health of those in Christian ministry leadership, or the non-flourishing and the ill health of some of those in Christian ministry leadership. And that's the questions we're going to be answering. Let me introduce the panel, and we'll do a ladies first here. So I'd love to introduce Emeka Topoliae. Is that even close?
Very close. Topoliae.
Yeah, that's close enough. Emeka is a clinical pastoral counselor with extensive experience, I think, in counseling people in these kinds of issues that we are discussing today. Rather marvelously, as a conversation starter, Emeka, according to her own biography, so she only has herself to blame here, is a member of the Hungarian Society of Sexologists, which I think is either a conversation starter or killer, depending on where you're coming from. To Emeka's right is John Kirkpatrick. John is from Northern Ireland and has been a pastor in Portrush, Northern Ireland, for the last 21 years, involved also in training and equipping people in apologetics issues. John brings a great deal of pastoral wisdom to this discussion and has also been very involved as a chaplain to the Irish motorbike racing fraternity. So looking forward to hearing what you have to say into these issues as well, John. And on my left, Glyn Harrison from England, but studied in Scotland, so he's all right. And Glyn is Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry, based now in Bristol, very involved in teaching and preaching on issues of faith, psychology, actually addressing a good deal of the kinds of questions that we're going to be talking about this afternoon, and also involved in personally mentoring emerging leaders. So this is a really excellent panel. I'm delighted to have you here. I'm looking forward to hearing what you all have to say. So without further ado, I'm going to first of all ask you all just to help paint a picture for people here of what this problem might look like, perhaps referring to situations that you've experienced. Who would like to go first? John?
I'm going to speak perhaps in the context that I work and live among, and that is in pastoral ministry. In the last couple of years, I think it would be true to say the figure is about 10% of active people in ministry, which is about 450 congregations in Ireland, and 10% of those pastors have been out of action due to what is sometimes loosely called stress, an all-encompassing term, which was a very frightening thought that could be the case, that somewhere in the region of 40 to 50 ministers, pastors would be at least openly in that situation. And I suspect that underneath there are lots of other people who are just hanging on by the fingertips, as we say. I went to, if I go back a little, my father was a pastor and he ended up leaving the ministry because he went off with a member of the congregation, a young woman 20 years younger than him, in the 1950s. So it's not something that's been far away from my personal story, so I understand it from the inside in that regard. And the church I'm presently in, my predecessor was asked to resign because of pressures and indiscretions, and his marriage ended after he left. Thankfully, he has been restored to a very flourishing ministry, which is a good story, and it does work that way often with help. But that's just a little picture of a very small part of the world. So I imagine that that's replicated in many ways across a much wider landscape.
So you're really describing a situation of 10% is a huge figure of people who are not currently functioning because of, in broad terms, stress. And then presumably another larger number of those who would be on the fringes or on the verges of that. And of course your own story connecting into this very much. So thank you. Glenn.
Yeah, I think these sort of data, the percentages vary a bit depending on how you slice the cake or what populations you're looking at. But that rings broadly true. I think there is a reality that we need to face, that there's a toll that ministry takes amongst shepherds. My wife sometimes says, Glenn, you made everybody feel so depressed, you know. And so I think we do need to remind ourselves, too, that 90% are functioning and serving the kingdom, and, you know, there is real blessing there. But we do need to be mindful of that risk, which is quite a significant one, that we're not talking about them, we're talking about me, that this could be me we're talking about. And I think, in a way, I'd almost put my finger on that as the problem. Nobody thinks that this is going to happen to them. And this fantasy is colluded with partly in our Bible training colleges. I am staggered how little people emerge from colleges, Bible colleges, theological colleges, specialist ministry colleges, so ill-prepared for the journey that lies ahead in terms of guarding their own hearts, managing their own emotions, their own potential for stress and difficulty, and just being aware of the pitfalls that lead down the track. So I think I put my finger on that pastors really don't think this is going to happen to them, and therefore don't put in place, and we collude with this, the pastoral framework that's part of its prevention. The shepherds are not shepherded, and I just think that's a huge issue.
That's an issue I would love us to come back and discuss further and just open up further as our time goes on. It raises another huge issue as well, which is perhaps a false view of maturity within the body of Christ, that somehow people reach a stage where they don't have any problems anymore, which puts even more pressure on those who are feeling that they're having problems. But let's park that just for a moment or two and come back to it, because I think that's incredibly important. Emeka, what's this looked like in your practice, in your experience?
In my office, in my counseling office, I see people in ministry who are, from the deepest desire of their heart, they are running and sweating for God. Yet they come in with depression, with anxiety, with broken relationships, extramarital affairs, pornography, addictions, and they stand there and they say, how can this happen? I'm a Christian, I'm serving God. How can it happen to me? One of the first things I notice is that they don't believe it. They don't get it. They are totally confused. If I am working for God, how could I slip to this dimension of my life?
which would really back up Glynn's point that there's a perhaps a certain self-deception. This isn't going to happen to me, or this shouldn't happen to me.
Very much so. I really see that people in ministry are prone to approach ministry as a project, as a problem-solving issue. And because of that, without realizing it, we start treating people as objects, thus objectifying people in our ministry, which is a very high danger because both of us will be hurt, the ones who are ministering and the ones that we are ministering to.
So we're beginning to move really from what this looks like to some of the suggested background factors that might be contributing to this. John, in your experience, what would be some of the factors you would identify that seem to be associated with those who are then struggling with stress or, as Emeka has outlined, moral failures?
Well, I think that what Emeka says regarding people's sense of realism is a big, big factor, that the understanding oneself to be a fallen person is, to me, one of the foundational things. Remembering that while we may have new hearts, we don't have perfect hearts. Therefore, we have the expectation that we will be struggling with our own fallenness. And that, I think, is something that maybe not everybody's aware of, and therefore the whole question of expectation comes in, their own personal expectation, and then maybe also entering into a kind of an unspoken contract with other people who have expectations and trying to live out of those. And then maybe if you add into the mixture of that the sense of isolation that often goes with ministry and Christian leadership in particular, that it's a cocktail of, it's really creating an environment that is very unhealthy and needs to be undercut by a number of things, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I can see that pattern happening, and I can see the danger in my own self. You know, it's when you start out in ministry, you don't realize that you're at the beginning of a long learning process. You don't realize that you only got permitted to learn, I think, maybe at that point. Instead, people think you have learned, and especially those you go to lead and serve. So I think that it's a bit of a mixture of that storyline going on in there, and then maybe add a few other pressures. You know, I imagine in our culture, because we're not sealed off from the culture, so therefore there's all sorts of other tensions and pressures going on in the culture that we are not immune to. And so now with the whole new world of the social media and the hiddenness of what people can do in the privacy of their own world, we can start to live all sorts of lives, multi-lives of what I am in my private world, what I am in my professional world, what I am in my public world. We can keep all going. But there are, I think there's a way of bursting that bubble, and sometimes it's burst when things all fall apart. But I think we can avoid that, getting to that level. Though there are lots of others who are functioning wonderfully, but when it goes, you know.
You're identifying several factors there, one being an inadequately biblical view of sin, first of all, our own sin. And then you're identifying certain structural features of relationship between leaders and their congregations, an expectation that they would have heroes who don't have problems, and perhaps many leaders who are quite happy to let people expect those things, and then are in a position of isolation where they can begin to even believe their own good press. Emeka?
I've been thinking a lot about what makes it so fragile to be prone to such falls and such brokenness within the church. And I, considering, first of all, my own self, I found two main reasons which puts me in danger. One of it is when I think I can do it all. Because then I don't guard myself, I don't guard my heart, I start thinking about me, and God just seems to slip out of it. The other one is when I don't deal with my own woundedness, and instead of bringing my woundedness to Christ, I start treating it with painkillers. Both of them will make me and will make us vulnerable to sin, to temptations.
Do you want to expand just a little bit on what you mean by our taking our brokenness instead of to Christ, treating it with painkillers? Just can you be more explicit about what you mean by that?
We all are wounded because we live in a fallen world. And we many times don't even realize the lies that we believe from our woundedness. And if I have been wounded from a family where I've been taught by an aggressive father that I don't worth anything, and I don't deal with it, and I don't have Jesus touch that specific lie in me, believing a new identity in Him, the identity that I have been brought on a precious price of Jesus Christ's blood, then I will start treating my pain of I am a nobody, the pain of that lie, and wanting the church and my ministry and the results of my ministry to prove me the opposite, which will never be able to prove it, because no human answer can disqualify a lie. It will be just another lie. Only Christ's truth can do that for me.
And I wonder if perhaps many, as you said, taking painkillers for this woundedness, many perhaps thought of things like entertainment or pornography or these kinds of things, but you're pointing at something bigger than that, that is actually using the position of pastoral ministry, leadership, and power to get something to make that pain better, success or affirmation and so on.
Yes, like for my insecurity, I might feel that I get security for the church's applause or the church liking me, the congregation encouraging me, but that's a trap. That's a dead end street.
Yeah, just to echo that strongly, I think a church platform can be an easy hit in terms of recognition and status for people, and precisely that dynamic can play, and even very successful people and people in the business world, there's a well recognized pattern of men who are struggling, often men, with quite deep down sense of not being good enough, their father who drove them, you know, down, and who are just compensating. And it's a treadmill. It never stops. You just got to keep on running. And I think picking up John's point, that that can feed into this conspiracy that there is between the congregation and the pastor, that will maintain the pretense that you are a somebody. And I don't think we should underestimate that, because they need an icon of success, particularly in a church culture which is very success-oriented. You know, if you think how many church strap lines, you know, transforming our community in Wisła, Poland, and beyond, you know, and that's the sort of mentality. Now, people going around their daily lives, they know that that's not quite how it is, but thank God, the pastor, you know, he is some kind of icon, some kind of model of what we aspire to, so we require him to live at a certain level of material, you know, income. We need him to perform in various ways. But there is a sort of a contract, as John said, that can keep this going and that we just buy into. And so I recognize that very much.
So you're very much putting your finger on systemic issues, the way that we actually think about how church leadership is carried out. And you're identifying some fairly terrifying issues. I mean, John, you and I, who preach regularly in churches, and when we do as well, Glenn, there's very little that makes one as vulnerable as standing up in front of people to preach. And the range of emotions that exposes you to can be very threatening. And that would then create a kind of situation where one looks for some sort of comfort or affirmation. Do you want to comment on that a bit more, John?
Yeah, I mean, I would be absolutely... The best way to deal with these things is, as I think, has been really... and they put it all out there. You know? And so I would say I'm as vulnerable as any person to that need, that temptation for the affirmation of a people to say, you're doing okay. You're doing okay. I have to subvert that consciously all the time. And there is a way that I function in my life to do that. But apart from my wife when I come home, who can subvert it for me and tell me where I went wrong, which is a good thing in a kind way. As a rule, she never says anything until after lunchtime. That's a principle we have. But one of the ways I find helpful in this is that as I'm a vulnerable person, I can then be honest with the congregation. Maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, I went into a bit of a dark tunnel of a place, and it was one of those times when it was more of an intellectual, theological intellectual tunnel, because I was wrestling with lots and lots of apologetic questions. And that's a place of tension in your mind and heart. So when you're wrestling with that, and it can be a bit overwhelming, and I would say to the congregation, some Sundays I would say, I'm not sure if I'll be back in this pulpit next Sunday. And people used to say, are you okay? I said, I'm perfectly fine. But I'm not going to, I don't know. I said, because this has been a really hard period I'm going through. But I'm quite happy to tell you that. That's where I am. But I still, you know, God's still there. He still loves me and I'm still trusting him. But I don't have all that feeling and emotion that maybe is associated at times with whatever. So I'm going through this time, and but what in order to protect against that, I have to be honest with the people. Now, it's obviously finding the right balance, and after being in the one place for 20-something years, 22 years now, there is a fairly good understanding. We know each other pretty well, and I might not have done that in my first year, I don't think, or second year, but I would have needed to say that to somebody in my earlier days among my leadership team. So being out there, I think, was so important, because if it's hidden in here, that's when it goes wrong. I find I need to put it out there to somebody, and somehow it loses its frighteningness or its fearfulness or its threatening once I've got it out there and say, yeah, that I'm struggling with that. That's a, you know, helpful for me.
What you're saying is you're advocating a level of vulnerability and self-disclosure, mm-hmm. which would be probably terrifying to many, even many in this room. But what you're saying is that the alternative to that is all of the kinds of issues that we're now talking about. What, in your experience, Emma, what stops people from that sort of vulnerability, stops them taking that sort of step that John's just talked about?
We are striving for safety. And we think if we become vulnerable, then we lose our safety. We'll be hurt again, like we've been before. And we take our own safety into our own hands. And we start clinging onto this safety idea. And without realizing it, we start controlling our own life. And because we cannot live our own life without affecting others and without them affecting us, we start controlling everybody else. So I really see it as a control issue in which we have a false safety feeling, because there is no safety in my hand, in my control.
Glenn, how would you go about addressing exactly those kinds of issues if you were coming alongside a young pastor, for example?
Yeah, no, I think as John says, there are a range of circumstances, and there would be circumstances where you wouldn't want to overshare, I think it's the phrase, isn't it? And leave people unnerved. There will be some people
appropriate
there.
Vulnerability.
It needs to be appropriate level, and not done in a shocking way, you know, not coming out of the blue. It needs to be part of a broader pattern of ministry in which the pastor also identifies as a sheep with the sheep. You know, that he has, she has needs as well. And that, and so I think, you know, that does need to be nuanced. But, you know, I think Amoka would be really helpful in talking about how a pastor at times needs to open up their heart to somebody else and deal with some of these issues. You know, own the issue and open up your heart to somebody else. But I think I'd go to, as well, to a simpler thing, which is, I think, just saying every pastor should have some kind of pastoral oversight, non-negotiable, actually changes the dynamics of this. Because it says that I'm a sheep too. And I think just that, without having to do all the sophisticated stuff, just that, if there's one thing you could do, you say, I'm going to grasp this nettle, and I'm going to talk to other people who've managed to do this, find out how I can make this happen. Because I hear this all the time, oh, there's nobody around, won't happen, it's impossible here. I would just go so far as to say it is unacceptable for somebody to be pastoring with no pastoral oversight. I say that, it's unacceptable. I just don't think it's godly, I don't think it's safe, I don't think it's healthy, for all kinds of reasons. So if we don't have a pastor, get one. It's unacceptable for me to be sitting here saying this without there being somebody out there who loves me enough to speak into my life at times. And I just say that's the case for all of us. You know, we need to have people who will speak into our lives.
And that's beginning to look at not only the personal but actually organizational issues, potentially structures and the way that we think about how church is done. I wonder, we've just a few minutes left of this part of our discussion. How would all of you advise a young Christian leader to manage the expectations of others? Because that's a side of it we've not spoken about quite so much so far.
I would advise everybody, and first of all myself, to define who I am in Christ. Dealing with sex therapy as a Christian in today's world, it's a very dangerous field. And the minute I go out to talk about the topic, I know that I will be bombarded with questions and aggression. And the only way I can stand it, and the only way I can stand up for what I want to teach, say, is if I very clearly set myself in front of God and say, am I right in what I say with you? Is this in line with your word? Are my words, my thoughts, my beliefs, my convictions, my teachings according to you? If I have it clarified and very precisely defined over and over again, then I can do it. If not, I will be changing and shifting as the wind comes.
So, a stable identity in Christ. If Christ alone is not enough, then nothing will be enough, in a sense. I wonder if I can just ask you all then a slightly different question again. If you were in a congregation and looking at a leader who is either stressed or seems invulnerable, or shows some of the signs that we've been talking about, how could you best help that leader? And this will be a question, really, I suppose many in this audience will have. You know, I look at my own pastor and I see this. How can I help?
That's a tough one, you know, because it depends on who you are and who they are. But I, you know, it's all about tone and approach, but I guess I would come in sideways, and I'm repeating myself, just with that just open question. I'm just wondering, you know, I just value my own home group, let's call him John. I just value the fact that I can go and see my old and great friend George, who speaks and doesn't let me get away with stuff, and he says, I know you're 65, but you're still going on about this and we need to nail it. You know, that kind of relationship. I said, who speaks? Do you have anything like that? Because I'm really concerned about pastors who don't. I'm wondering how that works for you. I think one has to come at it like that. But I ideally want to create a church culture in which we in this church expect our pastor to be pastored, just as we expect our elders and our other leaders to be in relationships of oversight, which nurture us as well as help sometimes with discipline and with correction.
John? I think it's really difficult. I have observed colleagues of mine in this situation, and it's been very difficult for me to know how best to approach them. Sometimes when I would try, they will become very, they'll close all the doors, as it were, no matter how gentle, how persistent, or how whatever I try, and there are sometimes I just have to wait until things get worse before. But I know that for many people who say, but who am I to go and talk to them? Because, I mean, that's my pastor, and he's going to say to me, well, what would I know? Or maybe not even, maybe he wouldn't say that, or she. But in many churches, there's a structure, I find. And in ours, we work with elders, and the minister is one of the elders. And, there are people within that team who will be able to talk to them, and I can talk to those who can talk to them. So there is another route, I think. There'll always be a kind of a way in. It most likely will take time. I think you have to be patient with it. It's not going to happen with one call. I mean, I can just think about myself, how people would address me. And I've had somebody, put their head in through my office after a morning and thinking, are you cracking up? As one man did say. And I said, actually, no, I said, I was never healthier. I said, it's a very healthy thing to be able to speak to people honestly sometimes. And he couldn't cope with the honesty because he was a different type of person. But that was a problem he might have had. But I think that there is a way, but it has to be wisely. It may be circuitous, but there is a way. But it's not an easy way, unfortunately.
Sure. We're going to stop just in a second and take some questions, but it seems that we're identifying common themes. One of them would be this idea of false expectations and then this isolation. And a consistent theme that seems to me to be coming through is the need for those in leadership not to become isolated. And that if the structure they're in doesn't make sure that that happens, then they have to be intentional about making it happen themselves. And then a level of appropriate vulnerability that models what Christian maturity really is and doesn't model a sort of false perfectionism. That might be one of our biggest enemies in this whole area, actually. Let's stop for a second or two. If you've got questions, write them down on one of these cards, pass them to the end of the row, and we're going to take about a 5-minute break, and then we'll call things back together again. My fellow panelists can't read, so I'm going to have to do that for them, I'm afraid. Okay, let's take some of these questions. And where I'd like to start is a question that actually touches on something that Glyn said at the very beginning when he talked about how theological colleges or Bible colleges prepare people for ministry leadership. Given all that we've said, Glyn, what if you had a magic wand, if I can say that kind of, you could make something happen to change the way that people are equipped and trained for leadership in our theological colleges, Bible colleges, seminaries, and so on. What would you change?
I think I'd really want to see our seminaries prepare people to be pastors and teachers. They say they're doing that, but actually prepare people to be teachers. With varying degrees of success, you might feel, but that often is the weight of the activity, and much less preparation for pastors. So the pastoral bit, you may bring somebody in like me, or I'm okay because we're specialists, who talk about depression or anxiety, as if it's something that lay people know about and can tell us. Whereas I think it needs to be much more woven into the work of the pastor teacher that we deal with. We're not therapists, counselors, but nevertheless, we have to preach the word and work the word out into real life. And in real life, there are fed up people and anxious people and vulnerable people. And I just would want to change the culture of a college so that it properly prepares people for both of those tasks. And I think the best way of doing that is to expect of our ordinands, of our people in training, that they are all in some kind of mentoring, pastoral oversight relationship from the time they start college all the way through, so that we create a climate of expectation. We're changing the culture, that you are just the same as the congregation. We all need to be letting the word of Christ, as Paul says in Colossians, dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another. And that, pastors, includes you. And right at the beginning.
And if you didn't see character development through someone's time in seminary, for example, would you stop them graduating?
That's a rumble here at that point, isn't it? I mean, it depends. It's so dependent that on the individual and what kind of ministry. But I think that needs to go on to the agenda, that we need to examine the strengths and weaknesses in our character when we think about what kind of ministry we're going to be going into and what kind of oversight we probably need. I don't know whether I'd want to get in to stop them or not, but certainly, again, it's getting it onto the agenda first, I think, is so important.
I mean, most of us would probably say we're aware of people in pastoral ministry who we perhaps think should have had a warning sign tattooed on their forehead at some point in earlier life. Some of these things can be seen in advance, and links to a question here, I'm going to direct this one to Emeka. The question is, in doctors, perfectionism, conscientiousness, introversion predisposed to depression, alcohol misuse, and various other different things. How do you think personality and then the selection of vocation plays into some of these issues? What can be done to intervene early, prevent some of these things?
I often find people escaping from responsibility by blaming it on personality. I think personality is a fabric that we receive from God, but we need to give this fabric to Him to create identity from it. Personality and identity is not the same thing. My father was a psychiatrist in the communist Hungary. And he told me a story that not much after the 1956 revolution of Hungary, there was a psychiatric meeting for all psychiatrists in Hungary, and the board director was yelling and screaming at them. And he said, you can do anything you want to do with their mental disorders. You can do anything you want to with their personalities, but do not create identities. Do not touch identities. Leave identity alone. And I think that's what we need to think about. Personality is just a fabric, one kind or the other. But in God's hands, it becomes an identity. It becomes a creation of beauty and something that we can bless others with.
So we shouldn't, therefore, expect to see one type of personality in pastoral ministry leadership. There should be a diversity, for example. And character, how that's developed and used, being more important.
Yes. I would like to refer back to your previous question, which I wish I got and not Glenn. Because...
Was it that bad? Sorry.
if you want to intervene and correct Glenn... I know it will be good for his humility, so carry on.
No, I was so eager to answer because I was right away thinking, as you said, should we stop them from graduating? And I thought, but we need a driver's license to drive four wheels. How about driving churches of hundreds of people? It is a responsibility. We as children of God are hurting and damaging people who are coming to us with trust and craving for the light.
But what, in a ministry trainee then, what would be, when people sit their driving test in the UK, they can have either major errors or minor errors. A major error, they fail the test. What would be the major things you would look out for, the warning signs, if you like, in someone who was training for ministry leadership?
Have they stepped on the journey of healing with Christ? Which includes our woundedness, which includes our forgiving attitude. That's my question. Have they stepped on that road? It's not where you are, it's where you're heading.
What would be some of the signs that you would see that someone wasn't on that road? What are the things you're looking for? You mentioned forgiveness, so clearly
yes,
some bitterness or anger, for example.
Bitterness is definitely one. Blaming is another one. Signs of gossip and talking behind people instead of facing our conflict. Not taking responsibility, blaming. These are common things. Common things we all do. I do. I wish I didn't. But when it's a repetitive, not confessed, and cycle of our lifestyle, our communication, our relationships, then we need to ask the question, I really believe, are you ready to lead people?
A simple test might be just how somebody responds to critical feedback on a sermon, for example.
Yes.
Because we all love critical feedback in our sermons, don't we, John?
Yes. we need it.
Just
serve us quickly. I think the problem is, What gets people in trouble in pastoral ministry, sometimes it's the big moral things, you know, the running off with the secretary type things. Most of the time, though, it's not big moral things. It really is these issues of personality and often quite subtle issues, but issues which nevertheless grate and create difficulties relationally in churches. And sometimes they're hard to put your finger on. They don't seem big enough to confront someone over, but they're there. I mean, talking to, you know, our pastor, you hear somebody say, he talks, he never listens. Now, is that a sin? You know, it's not a straightforward moral issue, but it's an issue of personality and temperament that people can go through all of their lives, never gets addressed, fed back, dealt with. Or conflict avoidance. This is a big one. And, you know, I'm 65, as I somehow keep saying this afternoon, don't know why, but I still find conflict management really challenging. It provokes in me physical reaction. You know, I've been through the courses. I know what to do. I've got I've got the badge. I've got the medals of how to do it. It still makes me deeply, viscerally anxious, as it does many of you. I think it's these kind of things that get us into trouble. We're conflict avoidant. We're not going to be able to run a church because you will run into conflict. And I think the sooner we engage with that and accept it, and again, that brings us back to getting into relationships in which some of these issues can be gently addressed by iron sharpening iron.
Because the question is not whether we'll experience conflict, but just how we will deal with it. And avoiding it usually just stores it up and makes it worse when it eventually breaks. Speaking from bitter experience, unfortunately.
We all do.
Yeah. There's another issue just actually prompted by something Glyn said there, and that is that the tendency we have to allow people's gifting and apparent fruitfulness to trump the kinds of issues that you then talked about. People say, well, yes, there's these behaviors or these character issues, but they're being very successful. They're being very used. You're nodding somewhat wistfully at this point. Do you want to come in?
I just think that it depends where you were. If we must place a value on that which the Bible places value, and the Bible places the highest value on the quality of love. And the character of humility would outplay for me any wonderful Bible teacher. I have been most helped by people's honesty and vulnerability, far more than their skills and insightful Bible teaching. And I think that while I appreciate that and have benefited from it, if it's not married to this character, I'm afraid the people I'll go back to for help again and again are the ones who I find are open, humble, honest people. And they'll really help me because they'll draw me out in a way where the others might just fill me up. And I think I need to be drawn out. And that whole sense of within the body of Christ, there needs to be this Christ-likeness of... I think when we need to mention this wee bit. To me, this is a bit of a kind of a... It's become nearly the way my whole life. The gospel winnings of Jesus Christ so strengthen all I can be. If I don't have those, I'm nothing. But those give me the freedom to be the humble person. I don't need to hold on to all these other things as a minister, a pastor, a teacher, whatever. Everything he has died to win for me by way of status and everything else, as a whole, you can add everything in there that it is, frees me to be that humble person. I don't need that anymore. I don't need to strive for it. I'm not competing with anybody. You can't add anything to the cup that he's already filled. I think that, to me, is so crucial. I read a thing last week in a little book by Carolyn Weber, which is a great wee book if you want to read. It's called Surprised by Oxford. It's about her conversion while she was at Oxford. But in it, she said her pastor, who I think might have been pastor in St. Ebbs that time, said, "We take ourselves too seriously, and we don't take the gospel seriously." We need to flip that around. Don't take yourself too seriously, but do take the gospel seriously. Applying that to our hearts then frees us, I think, to be the humble person. And I don't mean, you know, in that kind of patronizing way, but to enjoy that place, to find the freedom to be there with happiness.
And what you've said crucially in all of that is that the kind of person who is indeed humble and free in that way has had much more of an impact upon you, and I'm sure many of us would say similar things, much more of an impact than the super competent, super confident superstar.
Totally.
And that's a hugely significant thing that you've said there.
But the hope in that is that while we may not be this brilliant teacher ever, we can always be this humble servant.
Yes. Let me push on through some of these questions, and we'll just try to get through as many as possible. Clearly, we're going to run out of time before that. One really for you, John. I wonder if you can answer this one quickly. There's a general idea in pastoral circles that pastoral work is very hard, harder than other professions. That sounds like a sort of poor me kind of statement. Pastors expect others to take that for granted. Is it a myth, or is it a true statement in your opinion?
I don't think it's harder than any other professions to begin with, I would say that. My wife has been a palliative care nurse, and I think she's had sometimes a far harder task than ever I've had at times, day after day, dealing with that sort of situation. Even being a mother could be an incredibly difficult task, bringing up all your teenagers and everything too. I think it's what it is. And the church is full of problems. The church will always be full of problems. And we're in there, and I think we need to work with many other people in the church, therefore we need to just encourage them to take responsibility for one another. I think that's a big part. A lot of ministers like people to think, you know, I have a really difficult task. They might like talking about their latest pastoral challenge. Personally, I think that we all need to pastor each other within the life of the congregation. We need horizontally to be caring for one another and on all those ways, and I think that that's again another idea that ministers and pastors sometimes like to sort of corral these areas as though it gives them a sense of significance. They need to live, you know, give that out, give that away, and there may be other people in the church much better at doing it than them and for each other. So
we're coming back to humility again.
Yeah, just free to give it away, and you know, it may be that you can do some, but there's others definitely who'll do much better, I think.
Emeka, one for you. Apart from praying, how can we help a Christian leader who is in total denial as to his or her, indeed, inappropriate behavior that's affecting family, colleagues, and ministry donors, it says here in this question?
I did not understand the end. Please, would you repeat that at the end of the sentence?
It was basically saying somebody, how could, apart from praying, how do you actually help someone who's in total denial about behavior that's adversely affecting family, colleagues, ministry donors, whoever?
Show them a neon sign. No, a neon sign, you know, that they can see. No, we often want to approach people by coming up, and we think, okay, I tell you I love you, and now I confront you. I think we need to earn the right to confront, and earning the right to confront is by love. We never know what the other person is dealing with. We have assumptions, but they are our fictionary assumptions. There might be some truth in it, maybe nothing. So the first step I would do, I would definitely stand by them. As Glenn was saying earlier, you know, coming by them, not in front of them. Sometimes we just need to sit by them and ask them maybe 10 times in 10 weeks in a row, how are you? And dare to look into their eyes and have an eye that says, I'm open to your answer if you're ready. And hopefully by the 11th time, he will say, well, thank you for asking. I'm almost good. That's the only way. I don't see it very directly, but there are times when we need to go further. But the first step would be definitely approaching them with love.
Yeah. Let me move to a slightly different area. To any of you to answer. This question says, you didn't mention prayer in the Christian worker leader's personal life. Now, that touches on lots of areas. One area we haven't talked about is the fact that the person in any sort of Christian leadership is really on the front line of a spiritual battle, not just the battle involving our characters, personalities, and behaviors. So, who would like to comment on that?
Shall I? I'll just kick off. As someone who finds prayer so hard, you know, it doesn't get any easier. I just find I'm highly distractible still. This isn't talking from a great example, but I do believe in what's right and what I aspire to. And it seems to me that a prayer life that's disciplined and regular, that's pivotal to one's ministry, it really is that, it's pivotal. Particularly in our modern world. Our modern world with social media, with the internet, it's a very exteriorizing world. What I mean is it takes us out of ourselves into other worlds very quickly. Before, we had to leave the house, we had to get up and go to meet. Now we interact and interface multiple opportunities every few minutes through the media. And so this world out there will draw us out into it with all kinds of seductive possibilities for reinventing ourselves, representing ourselves to the world, making an impression, making an impact, influencing, learning, catching up with what it says we need to know, for goodness sake. And so it's pulling us out all the time. This is a recipe for disaster in terms of spiritual formation, because if we're to nurture our identity as daughters and sons of God in Christ, that has to be intentional. It's both a learned thing, but it's an imagined thing. It's a place we have to inhabit, that we really are children of God. And if we're to be inside-out people, that sense of rootedness to who we are then influences how we interact with the world. We have got to carve out space whereby we withdraw from the world in order to nurture that sense of self to equip us to go back out into the world. So I just think it's pivotal that we have a time of prayer. And dare I say, contemplative prayer. I find this the most difficult thing in the world still, but contemplative prayer, we are so activist as evangelicals. You know, into our prayers, we're straight into words. We need to learn to contemplate, to reflect on, to imagine the glory of God and His Son.
But making the space, whether we feel like it or not, to make that a priority is really what you're advising there. And I wonder whether so many of us don't pray like it really matters out of a certain naivety. Our heads are in the sand about the fact that we have a spiritual enemy and we're involved in a spiritual battle. And it's no surprise then, with your head in the sand, that a certain part of the anatomy can be kicked.
I think that it's interesting that when a person's in trouble, they tend to cut off all the communication, I find. You know, pastors and so forth. Yeah, I talk to them and say, well, you know, you're in trouble, so what's going on? So you pull the phone out of the wall, as it were, spiritually speaking. You're not in conversation with God. He's still aware of you, but you're not really wanting to be talking with Him. So these things tend to all sort of come together. And so if we're to depend upon our own ability to be self-motivated all the time, I think we're going to create a wee bit of potential danger in there. And that's why I think we are meant to be part of the body of Christ, and that's why we're meant to work together. So we need to have a mentor in our lives, whatever the word is. I have one or two octogenarian women in my life who act in that capacity, and I have one elder in the church. And when I went to visit, generally in the first visit around some of the folks in the congregation, he addressed me and said, you know, if you step out of line, he said, I'm going to be on your case. Now, I was a bit shocked by his reaction, because I thought, well, I've only arrived. It's a bit aggressive. But basically, he was saying, in the past ministry, we failed to help our pastor. We knew and said nothing. And I came home and I said to my wife, I said, you know, there's a man there, I said, and I think as long as he's there, I said, we'll be okay. So about a little while after that, I had reason to call with them to talk about going to visit a nightclub situation where there'd been a few deaths and problems, and wanted to pray before I went. So I knew he knew the owner, and I thought, would you come with me? So we started. He said, well, we'll meet, we'll pray, and then we'll go and we'll visit. That was 20 years ago, and every Wednesday that he's in the same town as I am, so he sometimes travels, we meet to pray every Wednesday morning. That to me has been so important, because there have been days when I thought, oh, do you know, I really don't want to go and pray today, but we are going to pray today. And it's really saying that, you know, this whole idea of, which is so scriptural, that we need the two together where the one who falls down can pick up the other one. And I think that's true as well in praying together and just the ordinary disciplines of the Christian life, because we help each other there. So that's kind of built into my week now, so that if I wanted to try and duck and dive out of that, it's not possible. And that's good to build into our lives, I think, things that are protective. And because the day when you don't feel like it, you'll still have it. You know, so that's been a helpful practical thing for us.
Thank you, John. We're over time, and I'm going to give the last word to Emeka. And your last word, what I'd like you to do is to address perhaps a group of young, emerging, or leaders in training, and you, from your perspective and the kind of professional work that you've been doing, you have one thing to say to them to help them on their way to healthy leadership. This is your chance.
Set your eyes upon Jesus. Everybody will try to get your attention. Everything else will try to get your attention. Your wounds and your pain will try to get your attention. Set your eyes upon Jesus, and He will hold your attention. And then wherever you go, you will know exactly where you're doing, because He's steady and He's faithful. And He is what He has been and what He is right now, and He is always going to be. If you want to have a journey in your life when you know where you're heading, just set your eyes upon Jesus.
Thank you. Each of us very happy to have further conversation with you afterwards, but thank you very much for being here.